From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. We've all heard stories about brutal violence, whether it's child rape on a college campus or suicide bombings in Afghanistan. But what happens after the violence? Today we'll explore the unintended consequences of violence. Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter Anthony Shadid takes us to a village in Iraq where a revenge killing has set off a new cycle of violence. Filmmaker Steve James goes into the toughest gang-ridden streets of Chicago and finds a remarkable group of ex-cons who inoculate against violence as a disease. And one decorated Vietnam vet on the one thing that every combat soldier needs: spirituality. But first, the common wisdom is that we're getting more violent all the time. Witness the genocides and world wars of the last century. But cognitive psychologist Steven Pinker says we have it all wrong. And in his 800-page book, The Better Angels of Ourselves, he makes the case for how violence has declined. Tribal warfare was actually 9 times more deadly than war and genocide in the 20th century. The murder rate of medieval Europe was more than 30 times what it is today. Slavery, sadistic punishment, and gruesome executions were common parts of life for millennia. Then, they were mostly abolished. Wars between developed countries have vanished. Even in the developing world, wars kill a fraction of the people they did a few decades ago. Rape, battering, hate crimes, deadly riots, child abuse, cruelty to animals, all down. Steve Paulson asked Pinker, why?
In terms of reducing day-to-day violence, both the insult that escalates into a lethal quarrel or the raiding of a neighboring village to abduct the women and kill the men, that has been driven down by the control of government. When you've got a third party that wants to keep the peace within its kingdom, not for any particularly benevolent reasons, but just because violence among citizens is kind of a nuisance to a king who'd rather keep them alive to supply him with taxes and soldiers, but that pacification of a population will drive violence down. And then as a government evolves to a more democratic form, you have the government acting as a third-party dispute resolver through the court system and laws. And instead of having to defend your interests the way the Corleones did, by the threat of violence carried out to make it credible, you call the police, you file a lawsuit, and that results in fewer bodies on the floor.
So you're saying it's partly the rise of the nation state. This has contributed to the decline of violence.
Certainly the rise of the state. Yes, states and empires, not necessarily nation states. But the rise of government tends to reduce the rate of lethal quarreling among its citizens. There's also the rise of instruments of commerce, money, contracts, interest, technologies of trade like roads and canals that make it more valuable to buy and sell what you want than to plunder it. And there are a number of reasons to think that the rise of commerce has led to a decline in warfare and violence. Also, I think the rise of education and literacy and cosmopolitanism and knowledge and open free speech have tended to drive down forms of institutionalized violence, partly because people get into the habit of seeing the world from other people's point of view, and that makes it a little easier to empathize with them, a little harder to brutalize with them if you imagine what life is like from their point of view. And the rise of a general intellectual attitude towards social practices. Can we justify what we're doing, or do we have to defend it in argument? And do the people in power have to defend what they do? When you start to have widespread literacy, a free press, people will start to question whether slavery can really be justified, or mutilating people as a form of punishment, or having public executions. And practice after practice fell when people started to scrutinize them, debate them. The debates caught on. They would embroil people in coffee houses and pubs, and then eventually the politicians who would sign measures into law.
Okay, you've mentioned a whole bunch of things here, and I want to sort of pick up a few of them. Coming back to the state, the government, which now often has more power than it used to in previous years, it seems that you could make a different argument, which is that with the rise of the nation state, it is actually much easier to engineer mass killings. Nazi extermination of the Jews or Chairman Mao's eradication of his political enemies during the Cultural Revolution. In other words, maybe there are less frequent violent outbursts, but when they do happen, they're deadlier.
They can be, although it's misleading. If you're talking about the effect of government as a whole over the course of history, and there have been thousands of them, to pick the two or three worst ones gives you a misleading picture of the role of government in general compared to anarchy.
One of the points that you make in your book is you credit the Enlightenment with some of this more humanistic way of treating our fellow neighbors. And I want to talk about that legacy a bit. The Enlightenment, of course, the dawn of the age of reason, I guess you could say, and to counteract old religious attitudes. How far can we take this to explain this new era of at least more peacefulness?
I think it has profound effect. For one thing, around the time of the Enlightenment, you see a wave of reforms designed to eliminate some of the institutionalized barbaric practices. That's when governments stopped burning people alive or breaking them on the wheel or disemboweling them in public as a form of punishment. Our own Eighth Amendment, with its prohibition of cruel and unusual punishment, is just an example of what happened during that slice of history. The abolition movement, the abolition of slavery, was another gift of the Enlightenment. It used to be legal everywhere in the world. Around the time of the Enlightenment, there was a domino of abolitions that eventually swept across the entire globe. Debtors' prisons, blood sports, absolute despots who could kill on a whim. All of those were questioned during the Enlightenment. Cruelty to animals, persecution of homosexuals. They didn't all take effect in the second half of the 18th century. Some of them did, and some of them, the ideas had to bide their time while more destructive ideologies took over. But then they reappeared in the 20th century, and the arguments for human rights that we've put into practice very much go back to the time of Kant and Locke and Hume and Adam Smith and the American framers several hundred years ago.
It seems that there's a profound philosophical question at the heart of this, and that is whether we become better human beings, better in terms of being more compassionate, because of our powers of reason, of sort of, you know, coming up with rational underpinnings for moral codes, or whether we act kindly towards other people for more emotional reasons, perhaps because we have been led to think this way through religious upbringing.
You're right that there is an interesting back and forth between the head and the heart, if you will. That is, do we refrain from cruel and destructive practices because we have compassion and empathy for the victims, or because we have a commitment to ideas like universal human rights that don't justify or don't permit the exploitation of other living things? It's very hard to know which came first, but I do think they go back and forth and they can reinforce each other. I don't think it can just be empathy, because quite frankly, I don't think that anyone can literally feel the pain of everyone else on Earth. Maybe I'm a bad person, but I just don't spend that many hours of the day imagining what it's like to be a starving person in South Asia or a victim of war in Africa. On the other hand, I firmly believe that anything that we can do to alleviate hunger and war ought to be implemented. I think that there's no other position can be defended morally, and I'm willing to put it into practice in terms of support for policies, charitable donations. Historically, you see moralistic arguments like how awful it was to be a slave and to have a child pulled out of his mother's arms by a cruel slaveholder. But you can also have arguments saying, what right does one person have to own another person? I think they've both been influential. If anything, I would tend to put my bets on the intellectual side, the power of ideas, that one often sees in the history of the abolition of barbaric practices, that it started with briefs from philosophers of the day that then went viral. The pamphlets were distributed, the books sold out, they were translated into every other European language. They were the subject of arguments in the coffee houses and bars and salons and dinner tables, and eventually influenced the decision makers. They probably needed a push of compassion, of sympathetic imagination. What is it like to be an animal who is mistreated? What is it like to be a slave? What is it like to be a child? But the ideas definitely had a huge, powerful influence.
Are you saying humanity is making moral progress? I mean, we're basically becoming better as a species?
Yeah, not that we're – I don't think we've become biologically any better. I don't think that this is a case of Darwinian evolution. But I think our collective global culture has been moving in that direction.
And to speculate into the future then, I mean, if you are right and we are becoming kinder, more compassionate, do you think our moral codes will develop even further?
I suspect they will in many directions. I think that our treatment of farm animals is going to improve. I think that violence against women and children worldwide is going to get better now that it's the target both of shaming campaigns from above and grassroots pressure from below. I think the tolerance of despots and brutal dictators is going to lessen. I think the idea of war between developed countries, which is already pretty much on the way out, is going to become consolidated. That still leaves a number of forms of violence that could still occur. There could still be civil wars. There could still be terrorism. There could still be crime. But to the extent that we can control things by our own decisions, such as the treatment of farm animals, I think that the humanitarian currents will continue.
Steven Pinker is the author of The Better Angels of Our Nature, Why Violence Has Declined. Steve Paulson spoke with him. Do you think violence has declined? You can email us at ttbook.org, or you can go to our Facebook page, where you can also see what everyone else has to say. For more interviews like this, visit our new website. ttbook.org features 10 years of interviews, now available to stream, download, and share. Coming up, a radical and controversial program in Chicago that treats street violence as a disease.
Violence is a two-step process. The first thought is, I have a grievance. He looked at my girl, he called me a name, he disrespected me, he owes me money. He's a Sunni, he's a Palestinian, he's an Israeli. The second thought is, that grievance justifies violence.
At the end of the day, man, nobody will win, man.
Our work is about thought two. So the interrupter's role, like the TB, disease control worker's role, is to do this initial interruption of transmission.
I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
Support for To the Best of Our Knowledge comes from the University of Wisconsin Online Bachelor of Science in Sustainable Management, developing leaders with the critical skills to grow a green economy. Information is at sustain.wisconsin.edu.
A man was murdered overnight on Chicago's South Side. Police say it happened execution style in the Gresham neighborhood.
What was a violent night in Chicago? 9 people were shot in just 5 hours. 1 person died.
124 people have been killed so far this year, 1 per day. About the number of Americans killed during the same period in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Epidemiologist Gary Slutkin moved to Chicago after a decade of trying to eradicate TB in Africa. He noticed the violence that was plaguing his city looked and acted like a disease. So he founded an organization called Ceasefire to fight it. Gary Slutkin describes Ceasefire's inoculation program called the Interrupters.
Violence is like the great infectious diseases of all history. I mean, we used to look at people with plague, leprosy, TB, as bad and evil people, and something needs to be done about them, and they were put in dungeons. What perpetuates violence can be as invisible today as the microorganisms of the past were. You can judge it, but it's not what we do in science. Violence is a two-step process. The first thought is, I have a grievance. He looked at my girl. He called me a name. He disrespected me. He owes me money. He's a Sunni. He's a Palestinian. He's an Israeli. The second thought is that grievance justifies violence.
At the end of the day, man, nobody don't win, man.
Our work is about thought too. So the interrupter's role, like the TB disease control worker's role, is to do this initial interruption of transmission.
Documentary filmmaker Steve James, of Hoop Dreams fame, was so inspired by the work of the interrupters that he made a film about them. It is simply called The Interrupters. Anne Strainchamp spoke with Steve James about this powerful, heartbreaking, and inspiring film.
Well, a violence interrupter is a person that works for this organization, Ceasefire, and their job is to mediate violent conflict in the neighborhoods around the city that they're working in. And these interrupters are more often than not, they're ex-gangbangers or drug dealers or convicts or all three. And they're now doing this work, this very redemptive work of working in their old neighborhoods. And because of who they once were and because of their connections and contacts and the respect they've earned in those neighborhoods, they're able to sort of, as Teo Hardman, who founded the Ceasefire program, says, hopefully intercept whispers when things are about to jump off or when there's a problem, that they can kind of step in and try to prevent it from escalating or retaliation.
We should talk about a few of them. There are three in particular you follow, and they are such remarkable people, each of them in very different ways. How did you meet Amina?
Well, as soon as I set eyes on Amina and found out a bit about her background, and seeing that she was one of only two women at the time doing this work, this interruption work, it was sort of like, well, we've got to talk to her. I mean, and the fact that she was the daughter of Jeff Fort, you know, one of the most notorious gang leaders in the history of Chicago crime, which is saying a lot. And so,
Amina, she had herself been an enforcer, right?
Yeah, she had worked for a very prominent drug ring as an enforcer. So Amina is a force of nature. We saw that before we were able to get her to agree to be in the film, and we certainly saw that, you know, while filming her.
And then what about, there's another guy you follow, Kobe?
Yeah, Kobe Williams. You know, it's interesting. When we started out, we had our eye on a few people that we thought would make great subjects, Amina being one of them. Some of the other guys that we had our eye on, you know, they, for whatever reason, decided that the cameras would be a problem for them, or they weren't interested in participating. Kobe emerged. He really kind of found us. He started calling us and saying, you know, I've got a situation in a parking lot where these guys got into it, and I'm mediating this, and I think you could be there if you want to be there. Do you want to come? And we'd be like, well, yes, we want to be there. And so Kobe, you know, really was a guy that showed a real ability to sort of get us into situations that you might not think we could get into. And he had this terrific way of sort of playing it off as not a big deal. He approached it very much the way I approach shooting documentaries, which is to not make it a big deal, to just sort of say, we're just doing this little thing here and it's no big deal. And Kobe was tremendously skilled at that. And then as we got to know Kobe, of course, we thought, what an amazing guy. You know, he has this very teddy bearish quality, this sort of everybody's friend, but he'd come from a tough background, and he'd used those skills of winning people's trust as an interrupter to great effect.
Did you ever feel in danger yourselves, you and the crew?
You know, there was one situation with Eddie Bocanegra, the third interrupter that we follow. We filmed a scene with him in his old neighborhood, Little Village. That was a great scene, and with an ex-gangbanger. In fact, it was with the guy that had been paralyzed that caused Eddie to retaliate and commit murder. And he was trying to get this guy out of the gang life. And after we had shot that scene, which was a great scene, word came down from the gang leader that Eddie wasn't to have us over there anymore filming anybody involved in the gang, and that that scene could not be in this movie. And, of course, we respected that, because to do anything otherwise would have really put Eddie at risk, if not us at risk. But that was it. I mean, when we were out there, I never really felt in any real danger. And part of that was because we were with the interrupters. And part of it probably was because I had the camera in front of my face. And you have some false sense of separation.
Like you've got a shield up.
A little bit. I think you feel that. You're looking at it through a frame, yeah. You know. And even though you feel very much in the moment, it still feels like you're filming a movie and not being part of the scene.
Though there are moments when, you know, it is clear just how risky the work the Violence Interrupters is doing for them, too. I mean, you visit one guy in the hospital.
Yeah, I love that scene where Tio visits the young interrupter who was shot trying to mediate a situation. Absolutely. And there was another situation that didn't make it into the movie where one of the interrupters, a very experienced interrupter, one of the older guys who'd done this since the start of the program, got shot in his legs. The work is really, I mean, it's amazing the risks they take. And I think what's interesting about it is I think that most all these guys around the table have had a lifetime of being around those kind of risks. They've either been shot at or shot, or in some cases, they've shot people. They're very cognizant of safety, but I don't think they think of it in the same way that we might think of it if we were trying to do that work.
Something that struck me, it's just a small thing, but a couple of different times in the film, a couple of different people who have changed their lives describe themselves as having done a 360, you know, turned their lives around 360 degrees. And I was thinking about it and thought, you know, 360 degrees, that's a full circle. It's right. Not that they've made a, you know, right turn and gone a different direction to, in some ways it's as though they've come back to the beginning, come back to who they meant to be.
We had the same revelation. We at one point late in the process when we were editing, we were sitting around there and just, you know, sort of marveling at the change people are able to make. And, you know, every documentary, well, maybe not every documentary, but a lot of documentaries love to capture that, you know, in a person's life. It's one of the fundamental tenets of drama is change, right? And it just dawned on us. It's like, wait, maybe what this is really about is people finding their way back to who they always wanted to be to begin with. And, you know, Kobe's wife describes him as a nerd. I don't think people in the streets described him as a nerd when he was in the game, but he was probably always this teddy bear. I know he was from talking to people. He was always this teddy bear of a guy, a good guy, a guy you could trust, even when he was in that life. And that's who he is today, but he's not doing all that other stuff. And Amina, I think Amina was always a force of nature, you know, no matter what she did. But now she's a force of nature for good. And Eddie is probably one of the most sensitive, thoughtful guys I've ever met in my life. And if you told me when I met him that this is a guy who committed murder, I would have said, you're absolutely crazy. That's not possible. And you're absolutely right. I think that that's another way to look at this is that people are looking for ways to just be the person they always wanted to be. And they've given themselves permission or they've had help in getting there.
It's almost as though, to go back to that disease metaphor, the disease model of violence, it's almost as though they've been ill and now they've recovered.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. It's like they've found the cure.
How y'all doing? I understand that on August 24th, 2007, that me and two other fellas came in here and stuck the place up. I know I'm deeply sorry. I know I made a mistake. I was 15. And I was following the crowd, but now I'm older. I'm more mature than I was, and I wanted to let y'all know that I was sorry for what I did on my behalf. I don't know how these two other brothers feel about themselves, but I know I made a complete 360 during my almost 3 years being incarcerated.
Well, with me, my daughter was here, and my baby, and you just don't know the impact that you put on my life holding us with guns. I'm nervous right now even meeting you. And I thank God that you have changed your life. But you just don't know what they have did to me and my kids. I deal with this every day. Every day of my life. Every day. You came in here, you asked for a haircut. You left back out. You came back in. And you did this to my kids. And Jeremy held my baby with a gun up to his head. And then filth on my daughter with a gun. And then you told my co-worker, Rhonda, that you were gonna kill her because she was calling the police. My life was in your hands. I didn't know if you was gonna kill me. My daughter kept saying, Mama, we gonna die. And I hold my babies. And when you wanna tell your kids, when you wanna protect your kids, and you can't at that moment. Y'all put up seven people in the little bathroom. We didn't even know what was gonna happen to us. But I'm just glad that you're a changed man. You look better, But you know what? I'm okay. I'm a better person now. And I hope that, you know, you be a better man. That's all I'm saying.
A scene from the film The Interrupters. Steve James was the director. He's best known for his film Hoop Dreams. He spoke with Ann Strangechamps. For more interviews like this, and for background information on Ceasefire's Interrupters program, visit our new website. ttbook.org features 10 years of interviews, now available to stream, download, and share. I'm Jim Fleming. It's to the best of our knowledge. From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Anthony Shadid is a foreign correspondent for The New York Times. He's won 2 Pulitzer Prizes for his coverage of the war in Iraq. In fact, he's the only journalist to win a Pulitzer for reporting in Iraq. You may recall Shadid was also one of the reporters kidnapped in Libya in the early days of the uprising there. He knows the violence of war. As he told Steve Paulson, he also knows that when war ends, unintended consequences follow.
You've spent a lot of time in Iraq over the last 10 years, and there's one particular town you've been back to a number of times since the U.S. invasion in 2003. How did you stumble upon this town?
You know, this town it's a nondescript town. You wouldn't find it on any maps, really. It's called Dhuluiya. It's on the banks of the Tigris River. I had gone there for the first time, I think, back in May of 2003 to report on what was then the American military's biggest response to the insurgency. It was an operation called Peninsula Strike. It attracted some attention at the time, although it's really a footnote to the war at this point. But that was what brought me there in the first place.
Why was that place of interest?
You know, I'm always interested in the aftermath of the story. I think there's the event and then there's the aftermath. And as a journalist, I always find the aftermath much more interesting. So I had gone to this town a few days after the operation had come to an end. And really, I just kind of stumbled on what turned out to be condolences. A tent had been set up to receive mourners who were paying their condolences for a 15-year-old boy who had been killed. And right then you got the feeling that something bigger was afoot. I started to talk to people and you realized that not only was this boy killed, but 2 other people had been killed.
Killed how?
They were killed by the American military during this Operation Peninsula Strike. And as the conversations unfolded, you realized that there was a lot of anger directed not only at the Americans, but also at an informer that the Americans had used, a man named Sabah. And there was, a demand for vengeance in some respects. And they couldn't do anything about the American soldiers. They were long gone at that point. But they could do something about this informer named Sabah.
Everyone knew this man had informed for the United States.
You know, they recognized him pretty quickly. He was seen, he had a bag over his head, but they could tell from his gait as he walked past people who were laying on the ground. More distinctly, they could tell that he had lost part of his finger in an accident, and they recognized this. And then they heard his voice, too. And at one point, in fact, during the interrogations, when this informer was working with the Americans, people started shouting out, "That's Sabah, that's Sabah."
So after this man, Sabah, had been fingered, essentially, as an informant, what was the talk in the town?
Well, it was, you know, even that first day that I was in Dhuluiya at that funeral tent, or the tent for condolences, people were whispering about Sabah's fate. And I remember one person telling me that he'll be ripped to pieces, but not yet. And I don't remember the exact words of another man, but it was along the lines of, he's a dead man. What happened, though, for weeks, and I actually went back to Dhuluiya a couple times in the interim, and I remember asking people, and, you know, people didn't seem to know what had happened to him. And then one day in the summer, in June, I was back in Dhuluiya, and I was talking to a friend that I'd made there, and he said, yeah, he was killed, and he was killed by his father.
Wow. And it's an incredible story. Why would his father end up killing him?
You know, it was such a dramatic. You know, it's hard to overstate how dramatic the change in Dhuluiya and the rest of Iraq, for that matter, was after Saddam Hussein fell. There was a vacuum, pretty much. And into this vacuum, this lawless vacuum, came the tribal leaders, the kind of traditional leaders of the town, the clan leaders. And they had a sense, a kind of frontier notion of justice. And it was very clear there was that tribal issues had entered into this. The boy that was killed was of one tribe called Ani. The informer, Sabah, was from the Djibouti tribe. And so it quickly became a tribal vendetta. And these tribal leaders, these clan leaders, said to Sabah's father, they gave him a choice. Either he kill Sabah, either he kill his son, or they, the tribal leaders, will kill everyone in his family. And so this father was faced with a choice of, you know, does he kill his son or does he face the death of everybody he knows, everybody in his family, everyone close to him? And he made that choice, a biblical choice. And he and his other son, you know, led Sabah out early in the morning. And the way the story was told to me is the father fired, I think, two or three times, and Sabah wasn't dead. He fell to the ground but was still breathing, and the father collapsed at that point and couldn't go any further. And the other brother had to fire the fatal shot.
I can't imagine a worse thing to have to do for a father or for a brother.
You know, it was one of the most haunting, and probably is the most haunting story I ever reported. And I went back after Sabah was killed, and I went to see the father. And actually, the father sat down with me, and he said words that I haven't forgotten to this day. I think maybe the most haunting words I've ever heard as a reporter. He told me that not even the prophet Abraham had to kill his son. And then he paused, and I remember his eyes glistened a little bit. And he said there was no other choice.
Wow. Did anyone, I mean, as this was brewing in the town, and clearly people were talking about this, was it just kind of universal decision among all townspeople that Sabah had to be killed, that his own family had to do it? Or were there other people who said, no, this is wrong?
There was a protest that came out by a man named Mullah Nadhim. He was a cleric in the town. And I really didn't understand that at the point when I was reporting the story, but Mullah Nadhim actually became a much more important character in the town. He thought these tribal leaders were trying to cover up their own crimes, that they had worked with the Americans, that they were trying to hide what they had done. And he tried to intervene. In fact, he had set up a meeting with the father the next day, but this, as the cleric put it to me, this man named Mullah Nadhim, that Kalashnikov was faster than I was. And it's interesting. I reported this story back in 2003. I wrote it for the Washington Post. What happened after I wrote the story for the Washington Post, though, was I think a lot of people saw the story as an example of brutality, that this is how brutal Iraq had become in the aftermath of the invasion and the beginning of the occupation. And that really troubled me. That wasn't the intention of the story. That's not how I saw the story. The story to me meant something very different, and that was how this very almost forgettable intervention on the part of the U.S. military, this Operation Peninsula Strike that was quickly forgotten, like I said, it was a footnote, unleashed this chain of events, this incredible chain of events that transformed this town in the years that followed. And it was just how the smallest of interventions created the greatest of unintended consequences in the town. I remember walking with him to the cemetery, you know, walking past the gravestone. They hadn't even, you know, fixed the gravestone really. And just that anger that this son felt. And there was an overwhelming sense of unrequited vengeance that, you know, the story had not ended, that the vendetta wasn't over. I remember another villager at the time had told me a story about a Bedouin whose father was killed and 40 years had passed. And they asked this Bedouin why he hadn't had vengeance yet. And he said in Arabic that it was still too early and not yet. And I remember hearing that story when I was looking at this brother of the informer as he sat near the gravestone, the marker. And I thought that same idea, that maybe it was still too early, that he hadn't had his vengeance yet.
Were you angry as you covered these? I mean, you saw the horror that was happening, how this village was ripped up, how probably good people were turned into to villains.
You know, I think every journalist, I think it's probably good for every journalist to have a little bit of outrage in them, things that transpire. Otherwise, you know, it's you lose that desire to write and to hold people accountable and to try to bring some meaning to all these things that are happening. You know, there have been a lot of times that I've been very upset and very angry in Iraq. It's hard to convey how brutalized and how traumatized that country is. It's hard to catalog and to chronicle how many people have actually died since 2003. You don't meet anyone in Baghdad that doesn't have a friend or a relative killed. And that's kind of a sweeping statement, but it's depressingly accurate, you know. And I think there is a little bit of anger of, did all this have to happen? What was this all for? And I'm not sure what the answer is to that. I don't know what the answer is until today.
You know, and you've said that you keep going back, kind of trying to find some meaning to all this. Is there meaning to be found?
Yeah, maybe there's not. I'll tell you, one word that always struck me, the word is ghamad in Arabic. It's ambiguity. It's, you know, something's ambiguous. It's unknown. We can't really figure it out. And that word has always struck me. It's always defined a lot of the experience for me, at least in Iraq, is that, you know, all these years later, it's still ambiguous. What's next? You know, what is going to happen? How is this going to turn out? And, you know, there's a very linear sense of things in America, especially when it comes to Iraq. We invaded, we occupied the place, We withdrew. Iraqis are on their own. There's nothing linear about Iraq, though, and I think in a lot of ways the seminal moments in that country's history haven't even happened yet. I mean, how this is going to turn out, the events that shape that, I think still await us.
Well, and there's also a narrative that's been constructed from the U.S. perspective, and certainly for the people who supported the war, it was, you know, the United States was seen as the liberators. You know, we were coming in to depose an awful tyrant, and we were going to help this country on the road to democracy, and obviously things are way more complicated than that, and you know, we became occupiers, right?
I think it's such a That's another thing. If you talk about trying to making these kind of more sweeping statements about Iraq, is how much it was dominated by this contest of narratives as occupier, as liberator, as something in between it. The insurgents tried to make their own narrative. You know, they did it through spectacles of bombings, of car bombings, suicide bombings, what have you. The Americans tried to do it through those images, those kind of lasting images, Saddam's statue falling down, for instance, or as recent as August when the last combat soldier supposedly withdrew. This has been a war of narratives, and those narratives, you know, I think have been a disservice to us in some ways of really appreciating how ambiguous, how gray Iraq really is. It's not a story of blacks and whites. It's a story of grays, and I think it's gotten in the way of us understanding what we've done and what are the consequences of our actions going to be.
But can a country talk about a war without constructing narratives?
I wonder. You know, I maybe it's not. I guess the narratives are probably inevitable in some ways, and you know, I think it's part of the job as journalists is to try to write against those dominant narratives, especially if those narratives feel, you know, less than truthful. I guess what's more disturbing to me, though, is that, you know, I think back to Vietnam. Of course, I'm too young to have really experienced Vietnam, but there did seem to be a reckoning with Vietnam after that war was over in this country. What was it for? What did it mean? What are its consequences? I don't feel like we've had that reckoning with Iraq, and we certainly haven't had it with Afghanistan, although that war is very much still underway. Are we going to have that reckoning with Iraq? And that's a question I wonder. I wonder if we're going to ask that question of ourselves. You know, what did it mean and what was it all for? You know, what kind of lessons we're going to draw from what's happened there over the past 7 years.
Well, and we tend to focus on what has happened to American soldiers who've gone over there and sort of, you know, the trauma that they've experienced coming home, if they did, in fact, make it home. We tend not to really focus on the people in Iraq.
You know, 100,000 dead. I mean, maybe the number's fewer. Maybe it's more. Maybe it's much more. You know, 100,000 dead in Iraq would be the equivalent of, what, 1 million dead in America. I mean, it's a toll that a number will never capture. You know, only the most dramatic stories really convey what has happened to that society, what has happened to that society's fabric, how it's been ripped apart. You know, you can't emerge from that kind of carnage anytime soon. And I think we do it at some level, some moral level. And I'm not sure what the answer is, but there's some kind of moral reckoning I think we need to make with what we've left behind.
Anthony Shadid is a foreign correspondent for the New York Times. He won the Pulitzer Prize twice for his coverage of the war in Iraq. He's the only journalist to win a Pulitzer Prize for Iraq war reporting. Shadid spoke with Steve Paulson. Carl Marlantis was a Rhodes Scholar and a decorated Marine who was awarded the Navy Cross, the Bronze Star, and two Purple Hearts. His novel, Matterhorn, won numerous awards and was a bestseller. But back in 1969, Marlantis was dropped into the middle of a jungle in Vietnam. At the age of 23, he was put in charge of the lives of 40 other young men. He was not psychologically or spiritually prepared for that, and for what came after the war. Marlantis writes about the experience in his book, What It Is Like to Go to War.
It was about 2 days before Christmas, and I had been on top of a very tall mountain and had been left there with just a platoon to cover a whole company's front. And we were exhausted, and we were trying to do the work of a company, pretending to be a company, and we'd gotten hit a couple of times, and I'd lost three people to a terrible friendly fire incident. And this was the first time I was actually in command all by myself of a fire base and the platoon because the company had left. So this was really my sort of first initiation into combat. And it was just before Christmas. And so I thought I'd read you a bit about what happened on that day. 2 days before Christmas, the fog lifted just enough to allow a single chopper to work its way up to us, a dangerous journey, squeezing beneath the cloud ceiling just a few feet above the jungle-covered ridges. Along with food, water, mail, and ammunition came the battalion chaplain. He had brought with him several bottles of Southern Comfort and some new dirty jokes. I accepted the Southern Comfort, thanked him, laughed at the jokes, and had a drink with him. Merry Christmas. Inside, I was seething. I thought I'd gone a little nuts. How could I be angry with a guy who had just put his life at risk to cheer me up? And didn't the Southern Comfort feel good on that rain-raked mountaintop? Years later, I understood. I was engaged in killing and maybe being killed. I felt responsible for the lives and deaths of my companions. I was struggling with a situation approaching the sacred in its terror and contact with the infinite, and he was trying to numb me to it. I needed help with the existential terror of my own death and responsibility for the death of others, enemies and friends, not Southern Comfort. I needed a spiritual guide.
You know, what's compelling about that paragraph that you just read is what it leads to, the discussion that that it leads to in what it is like to go to war, your book, because of the suggestion that war is a spiritual experience and you need a spiritual guide.
Right. I know most people are aghast when I mention that thesis, but the first thing about it is that what is spiritual experience about? What are religions about other than death? If we didn't die, I don't think we would probably do much of that sort of activity. And here you are, you have a 19-year-old who has been raised in a basically Judeo-Christian culture, thou shalt not kill, and they're all decent kids, and that they believe it firmly. And then suddenly they are transported, usually to some foreign country, and asked to kill for their country, which is totally the opposite of everything that they've ever done. And like I say, it's when you kill another human being and you sort of wake up to the fact, which usually happens after you do it, you don't just have a wound to your body or your psyche from the war, you actually have a wound to your soul. And looking at warfare, because it does deal with death, and 19-year-olds cast in the role of the gods, only the gods really should be the ones deciding who lives and who dies. And yet, you know, 19-year-old squad leaders have to tell a kid, you're on point today, and maybe he dies. Or we take the life of other people in combat, or even sacrificing your own life, which is the Christian God.
It seems to me that you're suggesting that our soldiers might be healthier if we not only talked about it, but had a more, well, for lack of another of a better word, a crueler introduction to what was going to be asked of them.
Yes, I wouldn't use the word cruel. I would use the word darker. It's this world of opposites that we definitely live in, light and dark, and accepting that both are part of life, part of the spiritual experience, is important because you're going to ask these kids to go into the dark side. And if they've never had anybody even talk to them about it, the 19-year-old isn't going to, you know, be enlightened and go into combat sort of like our ideal of the samurai soldier or something. But if you can tell him ahead of time, you're going to experience this, you're going to think about this, this is going to happen to you after you come back. It may not happen the first week. It may happen a decade later. But to sort of give them the warning signs of what they're going to face, they will recognize it faster. And I dealt with PTSD for 4 decades. If someone had told me what was coming down the road, I would have probably recognized it 20 years earlier, saved a lot of problems.
Well, and what you're talking about is training that sounds harsh,
yeah,
but you're talking about two periods in a soldier's life, man or woman, the in-combat time and the post-war career time. The PTSD is something that everybody is aware of, but again, hardly anybody talks about
now. Yeah. No, it's
and you think that training before going into combat, being more aware, will both help you kill and help you survive the killing?
I don't think it'll help you kill. I think that the way that you kill is that you don't want to take another human life. So the way that we sort of trick ourselves in combat is that we sort of get into the mental state that that person that you're about to kill is actually not a person. You know, words like gook, towelhead, ragtop, damn Yankee, you name them, and nigger, Jew. We have all these things in our culture that allows us to make the other person, non-human. I call it pseudo-speciating. It's a big word, but basically it's just what it allows you to do is pull the trigger on somebody who at that moment you don't really think is human, because if it was human, you would hesitate and it would be much harder. I had an experience where this broke down, and that haunted me some 20 years after the war.
You talk about this in the book.
I do.
You can still remember looking into the eyes,
eyes of a man
who was as scared as you were.
Exactly. And we happened to just be no more than about 10 or 15 feet apart. And he had been throwing grenades at me and my friends and had wounded badly one of my friends. And we were throwing them back and had killed one of his friends who was in the hole. And I had snuck up on the side so I could get a shot at him to stop this. And I was looking at him right across the barrel of the M16, and he stood up with the hand grenade already ready to pull the primer, and we locked eyes. And that's very unusual. And I kept saying to myself, and I was whispering out loud, I wish I could speak Vietnamese. Don't throw it. If you don't throw it, I won't pull the trigger. Don't throw it. If you don't pull it, I won't pull the trigger. I did not want to do that. He just snarled at me and threw it, and I pulled the trigger. 20 years later, I mean, I was busy that day. I mean, that just went right out of my mind as soon as that was. In fact, I talk in the book, I felt bad because I bucked my shot and hit the dirt in front of him instead of a clean shot. I mean, weird thoughts. But 20 years later, I'm driving down I-5, 2 in the morning, country music on the radio, a nice little bubble of warmth in the car, and those two eyes appeared in the windshield.
How old were you?
At that point, I was probably, 45.
How old were you when you took the shot?
23.
And you'd been in country for a while?
Oh, yeah. I'd been in country for a while.
This wasn't a fresh
meeting. No. This was where I said that it broke down. Because when you're generally, certainly in jungle warfare, you hardly ever see who you're shooting at. And even if you're just a couple meters away, it's really thick foliage. And they're, of course, trying to hide, which you are trying to do too. But it was at this moment that it broke down. I saw those eyes And then it was my unconscious saying, Marlanis, you got to deal with this. And that was a large impetus for writing this book.
Well, and this is the thing when you come home, when you stop being a soldier.
Right.
Or even if you stay in the army, but you're no longer in combat.
Right.
That you have to deal with. All that time when you took the emotion out of it in order to do your job, in order to make it a job instead of a passion. It sounds as though that comes roaring back. Once you're out of the zone, the emotion comes pouring back in. It's almost as though you have to experience all of that emotion that you kept out.
Yeah, I don't know if you have to. I did. I mean, writing this book, I'd have snot on the keyboard from bawling my eyes out because of trying to sort of, it would come roaring out. And I suspect that that is the way it works. You can't get the job done if you're completely in the throes of an emotional state. That's not going to work. And so you cut it off. But on the other hand, you still are a human being and you have experienced this. And in order to integrate it without damage to yourself, you do have to start to feel it. Because the way that a lot of people take care of it, which we need to watch for in our culture, is numbing through alcohol, drugs, suicide. It's a good way to stop feeling things. So that's why it's important, again, that you tell the young soldier that it's going to be okay. You're going to feel this, but that's good. This is called getting through it, not, oh, you're terrible. You're breaking down. And we have a lot of that problem. I mean, the current military has a problem. Guys are afraid to go in and get help for PTSD because if it says unstable on their record, they're not going to get a promotion. So, it's very hard. I think there's a definite debate going on in the military now. It's the other side is coming up, and I think will eventually work its way through and succeed.
So what do we do? Can you train soldiers ahead of time to know? You talk about needing a spiritual guide.
Yeah.
That's where we started this conversation.
Sure.
You need a spiritual guide.
I think that you
what
do.
What kind of spirit guide can give you what you need to get out of this?
Well, you don't need a priest in liturgical garments. I think there are simple things that you can do that will help you retain your humanity and your connection to the spirit. That, for example, if you could just train corpsmen, who are sort of the big brothers. I mean, because they have to do an extra bit of training, medics. They're usually older than the others. And you give them just a little training of how do you handle the grief of losing a friend? How do you bury the enemy? We used to throw them off the sides of the hill. And I had this one moment where I look back on it, I went, two guys in my platoon had, we'd been under attack for days, and he'd lost a lot of friends. And the dead were just down right below our fighting holes. And they had gone down and cut the ears off. Okay, they're like 18, 19 years old. It's like Letterman sweater stuff. And I had been in combat in country a long time, and I wasn't angry with them, but I knew you couldn't let that go. And so I just said, look, I know they killed your friends. You killed their friends, and you killed them. And I said, this is nothing that you should get trophies over. And so I said, I want them buried. And so I told those kids to go down and bury those two bodies. And that wasn't trivial because we were still taking sniper fire. And they went down, dug that hole, and they both started crying because they realized that they had done something over the top. And that, I'm sure, moved them forward to being able to reintegrate back into normal society because they touched what their humanity was on the spot. They didn't make them any less effective Marines. Believe me, I know those two guys. That night we were hit again, they were doing just the same job that they would have before.
But maybe because they had their grief then.
Exactly.
They didn't have to have it 5 years later.
Or 20 years later. They didn't have to be even afraid to let it come out.
Carl Marlantis, speaking about his book, What It Is Like to Go to War. He's also the author of the award-winning best-selling novel, Matterhorn.
Sweet is the melody, so hard to come by. It's so hard to make every note bind just right. You lay down the hours and leave not one trace. But a tune for the dancing is there in its place.
It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. For more information on After the Violence, please go to our website at ttbook.org, where you can also find, stream, podcast, and download, as well as share, TT Book shows and interviews covering the past 20 years. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Charles Monroe Kane, with the help of Veronica Rickert, Doug Gordon, Sarah Nix, and Anne Strainchamps. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.